Fellas, it's a very important exercise we're going through this morning in terms of public participation and inputs from organized business and other stakeholders on the medium-term budget policy statement. The MTBBS is a policy statement on the budget over the medium term. In some papers, it's called a mini-budget. I can't see the mini in it, because we're working with the outer years. If you go and analyze it, I just want to make that point. The other thing is, looking at where we come from 2008, in terms of this parliament, looking at the financial downturn that we also experienced, and there's still the effects of it, and we will encounter it for the next few years as well. We must get South Africans working. We can have the best policies in the world, but we must teach our people the ethics of work. To be proud of what he or she is doing and telling him or herself, I want to be the best. It's an attitude. Because we've got the National Development Plan, we've got the roadmap. But it must not be a document in a paper format. It's up to every South African to make that document, to that plan work. And this is part of this morning's public hearing, to get the inputs of the stakeholders, of the role players. And first on the agenda is Business Unity South Africa. Busha, welcome, Professor. Yes, the Honourable Professor and the Honourable members of his team to this public hearing to make their input. As indicated on the agenda, we're going to give you time until 5. Can't be 5 minutes past 10. It will be 20 minutes past 10. Professor, you may address the meeting.
Chair, gentlemen and ladies, thank you very much for this opportunity to address you on the MTBBS. I prefer the word mini-budget because it sort of rolls off the tongue easier, but I think we all know what we're talking about. Firstly, let me just perhaps introduce my team or ask them to introduce themselves.
Habeck Mosheng, I'm the Director for Economic Policy at BUSA.
Good morning, I'm Lee Padiachi, the Parliamentary Liaison Officer for BUSA.
Thank you, Chair. Well, if I could start and say that I think the point of departure for all of us and the point of departure for the MTBPS has been an overarching vision of the future, and you will see that our submission is indeed prefaced by a quote which emphasizes why such a vision seems to be common to all those countries that have successfully grown on a sustained basis over a long period. That you need to be able to couple that to a vision, a shared vision, of course, and as they put it, it's a bargain between the present and the future. And so we think that really that is the point of departure for us as a country and as business to look in particular at the National Development Plan and to see to what extent we can share that vision and that we can turn it into reality. Now, as with the mini budget, we have in BUSA had an opportunity to indeed monitor the global economic situation, and as in the MTBS, we also see a situation and we get reports from our members. They feel that the global economic outlook is looking a little better, both in the developed and the developing world, but with some qualifications. If we look at the United States, there is better news there, in Japan and in the EU, those three important players, although there are still some vulnerabilities. The developing world did much better last year in terms of its numbers, but still, if we look at the forecasts, they are still quite positive. And, for example, China is still expected to do perhaps about 7% or more. There are some of those emerging markets which are vulnerable because they have twin deficits, one on the balance of payments and one on their budget. And indeed, it is interesting to see that Morgan Stanley does in what they call the fragile currencies, five of them, which are listed there, and that includes us. Chair, to look then again at the numbers, you will see that the IMF, and we've drawn on the IMF forecasts to indeed substantiate what I've just said, that if we look across the board in the global economy, we still think there will be sustained growth next year. We do, however, draw the conclusion, as indeed do some others, such as the Minister of Finance and the IMF and some others, that we mustn't look for salvation there. We must look inwards and ask ourselves, what is it that we have to do in order to raise our growth rate and our employment prospects above where they are at the moment? And as you know, that the forecast for this year's growth is about 2%, which is also a booster forecast, and we simply think that's not good enough. So while we would like a stronger world economy, the fact is we can't hide behind that. We've got to concentrate on what we can do in South Africa, those factors over which we have control, and those structural issues which we need to address in order to boost growth and to indeed create jobs. So with that background world music, Chair, we turn then to our domestic economic outlook, and we compare the forecasts of the MDPS with the booster forecasts in respect of real growth. We just listed a few there. There are a few others, of course, but they all seem to suggest, whether you're talking about growth, about fixed investment, about household spending, on the current account of the balance of payments, which is one of our vulnerabilities, and inflation, we see that there's quite a close convergence between the forecasts for South Africa over the next year or two, both in the mini budget and in the booster forecast, and some of the other private sector forecasts. And so we see the assessment by the mini budget of the economic outlook as being realistic and balanced in terms of where we are now and where we might be in the next year or so. But in order to assess that, Chair, we want to briefly share with you just a perspective of, well, in a nutshell, where are we coming from here? And what is the perspective within which we need to assess where we want to go from here? And the point we've made in our assessment within BUSA is that if we look back, that we find we've really been, by and large, around a 3% growth rate for several years. In fact, for the past, say, perhaps a decade or so, we've been around about 3.3%. We haven't really found within ourselves the magic to really break through that ceiling as some of the other growth economies have done, and try and get up to 5, 6, and even 7%. And if we see this in the context, for example, of the global competitive index, well, we've lost some ground there, which we need to arrest and reverse. And even on our own continent, we now find that Mauritius is the leading competitive economy in sub-Saharan Africa. And there's the risk that Nigeria will become a bigger economy than South Africa. We're still the biggest, so it's a question of how we build on our strengths and address our weaknesses. So what we're saying, Chair, in effect, is that we seem to be back now in the 3% game, but we don't seem to have the growth drivers and the focused purpose that we need. And we know, of course, what's been happening on the labor front, and that our labor relations and our collective bargaining system are under great strain. So talking to to business people and to the economists within the private sector, we find that by and large, unless we can lift some of the constraints and the bottlenecks which we know about, we are stuck with 3%. But fortunately, that's the bad news. The good news is that we have remedies on the table, and in particular in the shape of the National Development Plan. And once again, let me say right up front, of course, it's not perfect. It's not complete. I think its own authors acknowledge that. But Busa certainly has taken the view that it does provide a vision for the future. We want to share that vision. We think it's a clear roadmap. It has some firm proposals. And it injects a sense of urgency into what we need to do, to quote the phrase which the minister also used from the NDP, we've got to fix the future and we've got to start now. So, Chair, just to amplify a little bit on why the NDP is important to business, because we do want, I think, all of us to see an economy which will be bigger, stronger and better by 2030. So we welcome the fact that the mini-budget is the framework within which policies and projects will now be progressively aligned. As I've said earlier, we all recognize that our economic performance is well below our potential, since the NDP wants us to reach an average of 5.4% growth by 2030, which means that we have the prospect, if we can join hands, to triple the size of this economy by then. But we know that at the moment, Chair, there are several red lights flashing about our sluggish economic performance. These were outlined in a very frank way in the mini-budget, and I don't need to catalogue them, but just to tick one or two boxes, of course. There's the balance of payments deficit, there's the issue of unemployment, there's the issue of our debt levels, which, although they are acceptable, are vulnerable. And it all adds up, if we unpack this, Chair, in the view of Busa, we just all, whether in the public or the private sectors, need to think long-term, and that is what the NDP is saying. If we want to successfully deal with the constraints on our performance, we simply got to think long-term and not short-term. And this certainly, from a collective point of view, is what business would like, because one of its great laments at the moment is that our policy environment is not certain and predictable enough for strong investor confidence, and we think that the NDP provides or can provide that certainty and predictability. It also suggests very strongly that neither government nor labor nor business nor other stakeholders will be able to deal with this on their own. We do have to collaborate, and that's a very strong message that comes through from the NDP, and it creates that platform. And at the end of the day, when we stand back, and as I said earlier about the world economy, we need to ensure that whatever the prospects for the world economy, we are carving out a bigger share of trade and investment to support our growth and development goals. Against that background, Chair, let me then turn more specifically to some aspects of the mini-budget which are welcomed by Busa and by business, those business people that we've been able to talk to in the past few days. I think the first point is that we see it very much as a very frank and a transparent process, and we congratulate the Treasury on that. We're pleased to see that on the revised basis we are going to meet the 213, at least the 2013 and 14 deficit, and that there will be a balance being held for the time being between the consolidation of debt and support for the economy within a context in which spending restraint is the key theme. So this consolidation of the debt is supported. We're pleased to see the tax receipts are holding up, but we think that may be a once-off factor in the sense that there are special elements that may have caused that, but nonetheless that certainly give us some room to maneuver. That it's important, as the mini-budget does indicate, that we manage the risks to safeguard fiscal sustainability. In particular, of course, we draw attention to the trends in the public sector wage bill, and that certainly needs more discipline bearing in mind that the personnel costs are now nearly 40% of government non-interest spending. We welcome the introduction of the cost containment measures in the budget. We, I think, accept on a realistic basis that in the total scheme of things, it's not going to make much difference to the overall numbers. More importantly, that it sends such a powerful message that wasteful expenditure in the public sector does need to be curbed and will help to reinforce through its message a culture of financial discipline at levels that might not yet be predicted. The next point, Chair, which we would like to lift out on a positive basis is the commitment to improve planning and decision-making in the field of infrastructure. This is important because this is not something for tomorrow or the day after tomorrow. In fact, these funds have been budgeted, and the important aspect now is to roll it out as important drivers of growth of competitiveness and jobs. Chair, the next point which is welcomed is the introduction of the tax legislation to incentivize business to employ youth and to facilitate the introduction of youth to the world of work, given the tremendous challenge which we are facing in that regard. We also welcome the continued emphasis on the improved access to finance and support services for small business. As you know, in terms of the NDP, 90% of the jobs to be created between now and 2030 are intended to come from small and emerging business. We think that the creation of the business incubators could be accelerated. The numbers look a little low. And we're pleased to see that although the fast-growing item in the budget is still, of course, the interest payments, it is reassuring to know that capital spending is now the most rapidly growing component of non-interest spending, and that's where you're looking to, Mr. Chairman, to add to productive investment and to grow. So, Chair, that highlights, in the time available, some of the welcome features that we see in this important MTBBS. Then there are also some risks and some of the vulnerabilities. Not that we necessarily perceive them. I think they were already hinted at by the Minister himself. But on reflection, one just wants to underscore some of these issues, and perhaps in its report, the committee may decide whether it also wishes to do so. The first, Chair, of course, is if we stand back in the light of what I said earlier, we certainly don't think that a projected growth rate of 3.5% by 2016 is certainly not adequate to meet our socioeconomic challenges. Bear in mind that even in the mini-budget, these growth estimates have already been revised downward again because of both domestic and world factors. Against that, the background music is also, Chair, that in recent years our growth has in any case been lower than in the peer emerging markets and other commodity exporters. And our view, Chair, simply underscores why, if we agree to the NDP, we must get on with it. Bear in mind that the NDP is not, as some other reform plans might be, it's not shock therapy, radical shock therapy. It's already a compromise document. So we must get on with it. That we must implement more of it and argue less about it. The second point is, because we're in this transition period of gathering all sorts of decisions under the umbrella of the NDP, which will take time, we do find that between the NDP, the NGP, and IPAB, there are still some inconsistencies which need to be cleared up as part of the alignment process. And this may be something which the committee may wish to take up in its report. The next point, Chair, is that there are certain quantitative targets which are vital. They may be aspirational, some of them, but nonetheless they're important because if you can't measure it, you can't manage it. We would only say in regard to the role of small business as an employment creator, we think that in this profile of our targets over the next, say, 17 years, one target that seems to be missing, despite the fact we say how important it is, we haven't set a target for small business. How many small enterprises or new enterprises do we want to see created, so that you can create the 11 million jobs that we want by 2030, and we think it could be, say, 2 million, but let's put a target down. And to achieve those targets will, of course, require an emphasis upon implementation and the collaboration with the private sector. Chair, we'd also say that, of course, if you stand back once again, the medium-term outlook is less favorable compared with what we saw in the main budget, and, of course, interest payments will continue to leave less space. But I think at the end of the day, Chair, what we are saying is there are remedies which we can access in order to grow, because eventually all roads lead to growth, whether you're talking about the tax base, whether you're talking about employment, whether you're talking about competitiveness. Eventually, you've got to get on the high road of growth, and you've got to implement what is necessary to get there. Others, which we might highlight as also being perhaps vulnerabilities that we need to watch. The other issue is, of course, we welcome the fact that there's draft legislation before Parliament in regard to the tax incentives to subsidize youth employment. We just make the point that on the same day as that was announced, the amendments to the labor law were passed in another house, and we think that we have to weigh up the job destroying aspects as we see it of that compared with what we're hoping for from the tax incentives. But that doesn't mean to say we don't need tax incentives. We do need to lower the cost of employment, especially for youth. The other vulnerable point, Chair, which I think we're all aware of, is our excessive reliance on capital inflows, which makes us rather vulnerable. And it's not just what happens abroad. Of course, the quantitative easing issue, although we must remember there are two sides of that coin. Once, if there's a solid decision and a good decision to phase out quantitative easing, that means the U.S. economy is getting better. And if it's getting better, that's good for us. So, there's a short-term impact, and then there's a longer-term impact. We do want to normalize that situation. We shouldn't have to be dependent on what the Federal Reserve decides to do and when it decides to do it. So, we certainly think also, Chair, another vulnerability to watch is that our projected inflation rate, even in terms of the mini budget, is above the world average, and that has certain implications for our competitiveness and the degree of margin of error that we have. So we certainly would like to emphasize, Chair, that we need this careful risk management. We know that the credit rating agencies are watching. We think the MTBS or mini-budget does create a breathing space. In the meantime, we must continue to address the debt-to-GDP ratio and, of course, the balance of payment situation, and continue with our fiscal consolidation. And finally, not an important point, but we did notice in perusing the mini-budget figures that the main budget deficit is offset by surpluses at indeed other levels. And we just make the point that, of course, neither is a good thing, i.e. that there are such surpluses, and b. that they necessarily make some other numbers look better. We actually want that money spent. Because if it's on infrastructure, then that's exactly what we would like. Finally, Chair, if I could just perhaps wrap up here and say that, as you indicated at the beginning, Chair, it's easy to use words like watershed and benchmarks, but I think the important view that came through from the business people with whom we spoke since last Wednesday was they did attach very, very great importance to the message of the mini budget. I think their responses were positive. I think they said why they might have put some of the issues in perhaps different language. I think that what I tried to do this morning is to capture the broad reaction. We see this as another building block towards the implementation of the National Development Plan. As I said, we in business have already engaged on aspects of the National Development Plan, how they should be implemented, because there are certain consequences for the business community, and there are certain issues on which business has to step up to the plate in order to ensure that we make a collective and a collaborative effort to get to that economy in 2030, which will be stronger, bigger, and better. And that's the spirit in which we've approached this particular document. So thank you very much, Chair.
Any additions?
Perhaps maybe I can just add something with regard to the NDP. Progress emphasized that we do have the vision, and now we should just see to it that it's implemented. So from the business side, what BUSA and other business organizations that have been doing, we have already engaged twice with government in pursuit of identifying things that will at least fast track the economic growth and assist in implementing the National Development Plan. If I may just highlight these things at high level, the first one mainly is maximizing the economic growth and social development benefits arising from public and private sector infrastructure program. So this talks to the infrastructure rollout, and we also identified the issue of developing skills and preparing young people for the world of work, which gels very much with the incentive that was indicated in the budget. We also are addressing, or at least investigating, issues around the ease of doing business, that essentially reducing the policy and regulatory uncertainty. The worst thing that you can do to business is to introduce unnecessary uncertainty. So we are exploring ways in terms of reducing this. And the other issue is, we can't do all this thing without, bringing labor on board. So one of the issues is looking at the labor market relations. So there have been a lot of issues around labor, and as a matter of fact, on the competitiveness index, we ranked number 148, which is something that is, it's not good for the country. And the last issue that we are addressing is around the inclusive economy. There has been a lot of talk in terms of, previously the economic growth will be at 4% and so forth, but who are the participants in terms of the economic agents? So that talks to, small businesses and so forth. So essentially, there is some work that has been done, and we are continuing to do that, and we will be meeting with government again, led by the president, just to finalize on the process. Thank you.
Thank you to BUSA. We will take the next presentation. That's the National Union of Metal Workers. Mine workers, metal workers of South Africa. Can you just move up front? Someone to assist the IT. To the committees, and you can make your presentation. We'll give you time until 10:40.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairperson, and good morning to members of the committee. I'm glad you corrected that. On the program, it says National Union of Mine Workers. It's not. And I think we must be very, very careful here, because the unions are touchy about, they're not just touchy about their names, because the names come carries a whole lot of policies and so on. So we are the National Union of Metal Workers of South Africa, and not the mine workers, even though we're all part of the one federation. I don't have a long presentation, so I'll run through the slides and I'll try and speak to some of them. The first thing we want to say as NUMSA is that, and when it comes to the medium-term budget policy statement, we feel that it is without question that the MTBPS must be premised on the absolute principle that government priorities and spending must be at all times be fundamentally geared towards reducing unemployment, poverty, and inequality. And I think the whole issue of the triple crisis has often been referred to in the State of the Nation address and in previous budgets. Although the 2013 medium-term budget policy statement has made some good pronouncements that we will touch on next, it also made several regrettable pronouncements which will have a devastatingly negative impact on the country's growth and development prospects and further worsen the already dire living conditions of the majority of South Africans. Government's wasteful expenditure. The union, we are happy that government is determined to cut back on costs, and depends on what sort of costs, but the kind of wasteful expenditure and the cutting down on travel and cars and so on. But we feel that these are a step in the right direction, but there must be more severe measures. The government will have to take much more severe measures to deal with the far more pressing problems of corruption, fraud, misappropriation of public funds and so on, and non-compliance with procurement policies and regulations. And I'll come a bit back, try and cover a bit of this later on in the presentation. So it's a step in the right direction, cut down on travel, cancelling of the credit card and so on. But we just think that there are far more pressing problems and we have to have severe measures to deal with that. We would have been very happy, in fact. We organize workers in the auto manufacturing sector of the economy. We would have been very happy if the minister said, look, limit the purchase of cars to locally manufactured vehicles. Given that the government spends billions in incentives through the implementation of the Motor Industry Development Program, and that's now been replaced by the Automotive Production Development Program. And we would have really been happy. The minister made some reference to an imported vehicle. I think it was the BMW 5 Series. Now, who determines what is a moderately priced vehicle? To some that might appear to be moderately priced. It just depends. To others, it might be a very excessively and a very costly vehicle. So how we measure what is moderately priced is it depends on depends where we are, where we stand. I'm sure if we had to go around the room here, we'd all have different views on what is it, what do we mean by being moderately priced. If we, and this is the crux of our argument, is that if you want to reduce the slice of the cake, then you must also take out the cherry. You can't say I'm cut the slice of the cake, but I'm still leaving the cherry out with it. No, you gotta cut that cherry out as well. Yeah. Well, another way of putting it is to say, if I give you a smaller portion of curry, then I must also make sure that I don't douse the masala. You can't have it both ways. You've got to say, look, this is it, and this is so proportionately to the curry, I've got to see how much of masala I'm going to put in it. I can't put 10 spoons of masala or 10 tablespoons of masala and still expect you to eat the same curry and say, no, it doesn't. It's an absolute contradiction. Anyway, leave that aside. I think the thing about consultants, now we're very pleased that the minister picked this up. It's the last company's attention. He never said anything about this in the February budget. But it seems as if it now has come to his attention of the wasteful expenditure on consultants. And in fact, we picked this up in the Eyewitness News. Lidiwe Malandu says that government spent something like 33.7 billion on consultants in the last financial year. And I think this is completely uncalled for. I think the whole point here is that over the last 20 years, departments should be making, and I think there should be a very, very serious attempt now to build capacity within departments. We're not saying that you can't give out work, and I think it comes back to the point that the director of the Community Agency for Social Inquiry, it was a comment that he made, and I think this is this is something that government should take very seriously. What he says is that there are certain things that government can do, and there are certain things that government can't do. And he says, for instance, like managing of projects and so on. But he says when it comes to measuring government performance, well, clearly you can't expect government to do its own evaluations and measurements. Sometimes that has to be done by outside consultants. But there has to be a balance. You can't give everything out. And this habit of just dishing out contracts, I think sometimes in a kind of very, very frivolous manner, is certainly not doing. It's not helping us build capacity. It's not helping us strengthen our research. Our research capacities. Departments have to become more. There's going to be more effort towards building that sort of capacity. The infrastructure, the union is pleased with the announcement that the rollout of the infrastructure program will be accompanied by programs to support the local manufacture of components, ranging from buses to energy components, in order to support the industry and create more decent jobs. The union has long advocated for greater support to be provided to key sectors of the economy in order to ensure the improved competitiveness of these sectors. At the same time, we were, and I think we said this in the February budget, we were a bit unhappy that there was a huge order, rolling stock, that went out to I think it was China, a huge order being placed, and we didn't think that was good for us or for building our local industries. And we noted again now, and that's why I want to locate this in this infrastructure debate, the renewable energy bidding process. We've been as LUMSA doing some work. We've been tracking this, and we noted that something in the region of 47, what's it, about 47 billion we spent in round one bidding process. But while that would benefit local service delivery, yes, that is true. I mean, the cement, the iron and steel, cement, and, all this will benefit local service. But we can't just confine this to input costs. And this is the problem, is that you've got to look, if you're investing that kind of money and we're building a renewable energy sector, and we see this as a very important development in the economy of this country, then we've got to look beyond that. Because the first round, you've got to say, how do we leverage procurement, localization of industry and local content? How do we match that with skills and technology? So there's a whole menu of things that we have to bring together. And we have to ensure that there are watertight agreements that would build and enhance our local manufacturing capacity. And just to illustrate that we're not talking as LUMSA, we're not really talking out of our hat here. When we did some work, and this is our own table, in fact, we actually presented this at a conference in Cuba on wind energy in June. When we were looking at South Africa's capacity, whether our local content requirements are adequate to actually build a wind power industry, and we looked at the local content, the allocations, the thresholds and the targets that we set in round one, the bid window one, bid window two, including bid window three, which has just been concluded in August. But we just looked at round one, we looked at a few of the winning bidders, the capacity that they were awarded, and, well, what sort of jobs they were creating. And there's a lot of money being invested here. But the one thing is this, is that all these winning bidders, most of them were multinational overseas consortiums working together with some of their South African business partners. But for the kind of money that's being spent, and they aren't that many. I mean, construction, we looked at some of the jobs that were being provided for in construction and operation. It's not as if there's been a flood of jobs. In fact, most of the work or jobs are in construction, and that limited to semi-skilled and unskilled work. And that's not. So we just feel that we've got to have more watertight agreements. If we are going to be serious about local content and localization of industry, we want to tie that up with skills and training and so on, and we have to have agreements on those specific areas. We've got to make agreements on those specific areas. If we just say here's the percentage, in fact, most of the winning bidders in this round one, they already met the requirements that were set, the local content requirements, because they in a construction phase, those requirements were already met. And it doesn't really help. So we've got to look at the long term, how do we build this industry, and how do we combine it with all the other factors that I mentioned. The solar water 1 million rollout, this is a very, very, this is something that the Union World Council is very happy about. We have an industry that is developing in the country. But I just want to say this, that we just met with EDD, some representatives of EDD last week. We're trying to get DOE together. We've had several meetings on this. We noted that we were happy when DTI designated solar water heaters. They designated it. And they specified the local content requirements, 70% diesel, 70% collectors. What we've noticed is that there are large-scale imports that are still continuing. Low pressure, and I think particularly in the low pressure schemes, large scale imports are still continuing. And we have I think it's about 70 to 80 odd workers currently who are in the process of receiving retrenchment notices. So it's not helping us. It's not really somewhere something is not right. How the tenders are going out, how the goods are being procured, because they are local distributors, but it appears that the issue of imports is just rising. So there is more imports and very less on acquiring locally produced components in line with the local content requirements that were set by the department. So how do we preserve these jobs? And this is a matter that the union is currently. We were happy with the appointment of a chief procurement office and the parliamentary budget office. We were quite happy with that. We did say that in the 2013 budget in February. But there are things that are not very clear. We really don't know. Is the parliamentary budget office fully functional? Is it fully staffed? Has it been set up? And the question that we have, and this is something that's beginning to worry us, is whether the PBO is there to rubber stamp government budgetary decisions or include in its broader mandate the task of listening to community voices on matters of the fiscus. And this is very vague. So we want to know, what is the role of this parliamentary budget office? And is it now functional? And what is its real mandate? The budget deficit, we noted what the minister said about reducing from 4.2 to 3%. In order to stabilize public debt and contain spending on wages and goods and services. Such a policy pronouncement is inappropriate in the prevailing challenging economic environment that the country finds itself in. During an ongoing crisis of the sort we remain within, deficit spending should rise to make up for a stagnant private sector by all accounts and in order to ensure the country's developmental needs are met. And I'm going to just raise this again in that, because it seems as if there's a some ways to sideline the United Nations, the UNTAC, the United Nations Trade and Development Report, in preference for the IMF Article 4 Country Report. The IMF Article 4 Country Report, in fact, is an anti-working class document. If you look at the policy recommendations in that document, and it sets it out, it speaks of wage restraint, it speaks of labor flexibility, and it's not being weighed against the other report, which is the United Nations. And the United Nations report, and this is our opinion, is that we think it's a more balanced analysis of the state of the global economics, and it proposes a different set of policy instruments. And we think this is where the debate should be. You can't just look at the IMF country report, and then we seem to be leaning too much towards that. We need to look at these, take the two reports, and let's see, and let's look at right now the UNCTAD report, it's clearly being sidelined, it's being pushed aside. Although the minister in the newspapers did say, the minister of trade and industry did say he welcomed the report, and he thought there were things in there that we could learn from. On education, health, and social protection, the medium-term budget policy statement outlines that to decrease the wage bill by restraining growth. criminal justice departments. This announcement is especially disconcerting because these departments continue to underperform because of a lack of adequate personnel. The drive of Treasury to decrease the budget deficit and the cost of service delivery is a falling series. We cannot expect to address the challenges that we confront in schools and hospitals if they are not adequately staffed. And we listed out a whole lot of things here. Schools, the allocations, and I think when the on the scorecard, the allocations for education might have looked impressive, but you have to look in and take into account all the other externalities, like pupil to teacher ratio, the fact that children are still sitting in mud schools, and so on. You have to take all of these things into account when you weigh up whether the allocation is reasonable or sufficient. So we don't think we can just look at a number. Numbers sometimes can be very misleading. You have to look at all the other external costs, at least external factors. We are happy that the Department of Health will be introducing a new vaccine to reduce the incidence of cervical cancer. We're happy with that, but we're not happy that the NHI, and there's a lot being said about the NHI, what we find is that there isn't really a funding model. We're still waiting for a funding model. And the slow progress of the NHI in the absence of a coherent health policy framework is problematic, especially considering the enormity of our healthcare challenge. We welcome the establishment of more shelters for victims of gender-based violence and substance abuse. As we approach the country's 16 days of activism, which is not too far away now, of no violence against women and child abuse in November, it is great to see such projects being advanced by government. So we are quite happy that government is doing something about this, and we are raising consciousness about these issues. Land and agrarian reform. What we found is that the medium-term budget policy statement only makes mention that funds will be reprioritized for investment for farms that have been acquired through the land reform program. However, funds for further land acquisitions are being curtailed, even though there are still huge backlogs in the land reform and agrarian reform program. So we feel that we have to take this. I mean, given that 2013 marks the centenary of the 1930 Land Act. I'm not going to say anything here on the NDP. I think we've said, I think the position of the union is a strong political position. Certainly we've had discussions, we've had it in the ranks of the alliance and so on. So I'm not going to say anything much about the NDP. I think the union's position on that is very clear. And I'm not going to say anything about the draft employment tax incentive bill. 2 weeks ago we were here, I think 2 weeks ago, and I think we said a mouthful on that. So, and again, our position out there remains unchanged. In summary, what we're saying is that you're going to deal with unemployment, and you have to deal with unemployment as a structural issue. It's a much broader issue, structural issue, and that we have to examine a range of both macro and microeconomic policies and how we address the issue of unemployment. In conclusion, LUMSA has consistently called on government to implement policies that are in line with our demands in the Freedom Charter, and we will continue to organize the working class and social formations to join us in the struggle for social and economic justice. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you to LUMSA for that input. Honourable members, there will now be time for questions. Fedusa was still tied up in a meeting that came upon them this morning in Johannesburg, so I don't know if they will turn up here. And Solidarity's plane, if on time, landed at 10:30. So they may join us after the questions. Vola Kurnos, Dr. Luyenge. In that order.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairperson. Just two questions to Professor Parsons. First one, do you read any indication in this statement that we will see higher taxes in February next year? And then, second question, you know, I can't remember where I've read it, but there is an appetite for South African business to invest outside South Africa into Africa. If you read the ShopRite checkers annual report yesterday, I think they have growth about 8% in South Africa, but between 12 and 14% in the rest. So they say the higher the profit, the higher the risk. Now, are South African business and maybe European businesses, are they prepared to take a higher risk in Africa than they are prepared to take in South Africa? And if so, what you know, why? And then, you know, if you look at the growth rates in sub-Saharan Africa, is growth not coming at a price? Is there not less human rights where you have huge growth rates? Is there not less media freedom where you have huge growth rates? Is there not less of a structure where the way you're living where there is huge growth rates? And is that not being chased by people who like to make a profit? I'm not against making profits, but you know, I'm just trying to compare. You know, you look at South Africa, we've got, you know, you can tick so many things we've got in line with the developed world. That's not necessarily the case in some other parts of Africa.
Thank you, Chair. It's just one question to each presenter. The first one to Prof is around the alluded inconsistencies found in the National Development Plan. What is the view of PUSA with regard to the broader NDP, and are there any specific areas where they think as PUSA there is no consistency? And then to Nomsa, I don't know whether Nomsa is quite aware of the role that will be played by the Parliamentary Budget Office in terms of ensuring that Parliament is not just there to confirm, but to fully participate and engage and further advise Treasurer on issues and areas where finances are needed most. So where is the loose head around that? Because it empowers Parliament with that kind of expertise that is needed, that might not be found in the members, because we are no specialists or gurus of finance. But if you have that office, then you have a vibrant, you have a knowledgeable institution. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair, and with your co-chair. Chair, my first clarity goes to Professor Raymond. Prof, thank you very much for your presentation, which is quite informative, especially that you look at the weaknesses of the NTBPS, and you have got some proposal that we need to look at, and for that it makes then your presentation quite informative to us. Thank you. Now, Prof, the BOP, balance of payment. If you look at what the minister said or the treasury said, they sort of decided to adopt a new formula where they've included the extraordinary payments and the extraordinary receipts. And as a result, then the bottom number was different, giving us some hope, not actually saying that we've got enough in our pockets, but it make a change on percentages. Now, if you look at that formula, I don't know if you did take time to look at it. Can we improve on? Can the National Treasury improve on that? If so, can you advise us as to how they can improve on that, or is it fine, say, an effective new formula that has been adopted by the Treasury? And I understand your concerns regarding the amendments on the bill that was done on the NSOP while we're talking about the employment tax incentives. But I would like you, Prof, to maybe try and expatiate your concerns so that we all understand them, because for me it's more of a, they're not contradicting one another on a policy statement. Those are two different policies. The other one is talking about the basic conditions of employment, which I think you are saying they are not becoming flexible to the sector, but exactly what is it? What exactly is it? Because policy-wise, it's different. The employment tax incentives, if you compare with that one, it's different. And coming to the NUMSA, you know, comrades, Chair, this is our country, and we need to make sure that economic growth is a very difficult thing to everybody in the whole world. And we need to try and avoid ways which become a threat to the investors. Because investors have got expectations, and they are expecting something out of what they put into their businesses. And to have words like devastatingly negative impact on the country's growth and development prospects, hey Chair, that is too much. That is really, really too much. Not when the National Treasury is trying so much, and the NUMSA is coming with such a destroying, destructive words. What is the word going to say about this? Because like what was said, uncertainty destroys economic growth. All I'm requesting is that I don't say, let us not hear negativity about the MTBPS, but let us try and avoid destroying one of our own. Now, Chair, coming to the, I think it's slide number two, still on slide number three, that the minister was expected to focus limiting the purchase of cars to local manufacturer vehicles. How does the NUMSA seeing that practice being done by National Treasury when South Africa is living in a global village? Can they explain that to us? I do understand the other slide, Chair, which is on page 4 on their presentation. I do share the concerns about the consultants. It's a fact. We all need to pull our socks and make sure that somewhere it has to stop. But as NUMSA, what strategy is there to assist us, because we engage with the businesses almost every day, to try and make sure that whatever skills that they were transferred, they were agreed upon to be transferred, are being transferred. Can you give us a database that indeed you did monitor that a particular company signed a BEE contract and they agreed to transfer the skills, and indeed the skills were transferred? Because the problem is that it's exactly there, that consultants are there, and with one goal of transferring skills. So in your database, can you give us that information? Thank you, Chair.
Uncle Harris.
Thanks, Chair. Let me start, I'll work backwards, if you don't mind. Thank you for both the presentations. Let me start with the last one. And the last point made, Chair, between the time we saw the presentation from the National Union of Better Workers and now, this committee has actually approved a committee report on the Employment Tax Incentive Bill, and it's coming up for debate in Parliament on Thursday. So given the fact that they've underlined their opposition to it, I think on the basis that the Finance Minister recommitted to the incentive in the MTBPS, and the fact that in those public hearings I think it was Kusatu said that they would be taking political steps to prevent the implementation of the Employment Tax Incentive Bill. Is that still the position of the Kusatu unions? Because I believe that if they are planning to take political steps, they appear to be running out of time, Chair, because my sense is that the bill has broad support from all the parties in Parliament who will presumably pass it on Thursday. Chair, I'm interested in NUMSA's position on a statement made on page 30 of the medium-term budget policy statement. It says, where capitalization of core public assets may be required, upfront disposal of non-core assets will be considered. To me, this is resurrecting the idea of privatization as an option for government, where there are non-core assets, where there's a logic to privatizing them. I read in there that this is now the resurrection of that idea. I think that's a good thing for this country. I think there are too many state assets that are merely a drain on the fiscus. What would NUMSA say to that proposal in the medium-term budget policy statement? And then, Chair, last two questions to NUMSA. Broadly, in the presentation, NUMSA is arguing for more money to be spent on various programs, including on infrastructure. I have a suspicion why there is not more money in the MTB is put behind infrastructure. It's because, Chair, we actually don't manage to spend all the money we put into infrastructure. Every infrastructure number the government tables in the past 3 years has been underspent by an average of 22%. So the problem there, of course, is capacity. It's all very well saying we need to be spending more. I believe we need to be spending more. But if the state doesn't have the capacity to spend it, what does NUMSA believe should be done? And then, lastly, Chair, on page 7, NUMSA has a passionate argument against reducing the budget deficit number over the medium term. Of course, the reason why Treasury is doing this is not because of some ideological position. They're doing this is because the fastest growing item on our budget in the next 3 years is interest payments. If you run higher budget deficits, you have to borrow the money from somewhere, and you have to pay that money back. So interest payments increased by almost 10% for the next 3 years. What that means is even with the debt reduction that Treasury's, or rather the deficit reduction that the Treasury's forecasting, by 2016 we'll be spending 140 billion rand a year on debt servicing. That's more than we'll spend in 2016 on healthcare, the Treasury points out. So I would also love, I think, to be able to run expansive fiscal policy forever. But it's simply impossible unless you want to disregard the debt that you're incurring. I'm really interested in how NUMSA suggests we can, what the model that they're proposing is sustainable. How could we do what you're proposing without debt overwhelming us? Then, Chair, to Busa, the table that Busa started with was really illuminating. I'm amazed to see that we're growing lower than the world average. I mean, in effect, South Africa is a drag on world growth. And you see clearly from that table that emerging markets are growing faster than the average and the developed markets are growing slower. I think that's probably expected. The theories of convergence are relatively accepted across the economic discipline. But clearly South Africa is not converging. We are not growing faster than the developed markets. We're growing around the same speed as them. And we're growing about half the speed of other emerging markets like Chile, Malaysia, and Turkey. Now, the one way to get growth going, I believe Busa would agree with the sentiment, is to see implementation of the NDP. And I think you're correct to point out that the NDP was supported politically and in sentiment by the finance minister, which is something that he needs to do. But my major concern with this is that there are no new specifics or budgeted allocations to support the national debt. Now, the minister, when we asked him about this, he misunderstood me and thought that I was asking for new policies. I'm not. I'm asking for new aspects of the NDP to appear in the budget. That has not happened. That makes me concerned about our ability to drive growth higher. If I can just, Chair, underline my question from the question from my colleague on the recalibration of the deficit measure. Essentially what Treasury's done is they're including extraordinary receipts in the income side of the calculation to get to the budget deficit. Now, I've told the Minister that I don't agree with this position. I believe what that will allow you to do is sell the family silver in order to make your budget balance. Essentially, this year, if we sold 10 billion rands worth of state assets, we would reduce the budget deficit by 0.1%. I think in terms of accounting practice, that's not good practice. We should establish our budget balance, and then any assets we sell should go into drawing down debt. Would Busa agree with me on that? And then lastly, Chair, the youth wage subsidy that's in the Employment Tax Incentive Bill that is coming before Parliament on Thursday is not the version that was originally tabled three years ago. It's been substantially watered down. You can see that the price will be anything up to 3 billion instead of 5 billion. The beneficiaries will be about 200,000 over 3 years instead of 400,000. What is Busa's view on those changes? Thank you.
Honourable Joseph.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. I just wanted to know from Professor Parsons, the unrest at the moment in South Africa and instability in certain towns and provinces, does it also has an impact on in your view, about what we need to achieve in terms of the economic growth? And then you've mentioned only Mauritius and Nigeria, so I'd like to know what is the picture around South Africa versus Africa in terms of that competition that we have at the moment, and what is it that we need to do right that the other countries are doing that perhaps we are not doing. And then I'd like to know what is your realistic figure about what governments would give as employment figures, not to create unrealistic expectations, you know, for the youth that is unemployed, because we are raising some figures from all quarters, and I'm just worried that we create an expectation and which could blow up in our face. I would like to know, do you believe that the small businesses at the moment is over-regulated, you know, in terms of some quarters we have people are struggling to come get off the ground with all the rules and regulations? I would like your guidance on that. And then I just want to make a comment that you've raised about budget deficit, page 11, and you refer to surpluses, but I think it's actually the underspending in some of the provinces that have created that money, and not necessarily in terms of the word that created the surplus. Honourable Chair, in terms of NUMSA, I just wanted to raise a point, wanted to know from them in terms of their comment about this corruption and fraud, which government takes serious. I'd like to know from NUMSA, how can they assist? What are they doing in their organizations when you do you have such these cases, and what is your role that you play within your structures so that we can all be on the same path, not just ask government to deal with it, because some of the organizations that work for have dealings with government are also implicated in this corruption and misappropriation of funds. And then I want to just bring to your attention that the BMWs and the Mercs is also not locally manufactured. It's just we're doing it for Germany, but I think it's locally manufactured, so I think we need to also talk about maybe go further into that as well. The consultants you referred to, I want to make the comment that some of the consultants on our oversight visits are actually ex-government expertise. That has been chased away, some of them, because of other laws that we use, and now we're using them as consultants. Actually, they now make their own cash, besides what they were earning when they work for the government. And I think we should use a mentorship program with the expertise, exit program called mentorship program, and use that skills before we just say people must go, and then afterwards when they form their own companies, we are forced to take them back, particularly engineering and certain scarce skills that we do have. And then I would just last make a comment about your statement on the NDP. It seems to me you do not want to participate in the NDP, but government have had Asgisa and Gay and various policy programs to enhance economic growth. So I would like to say, rather participate and comment, like you've commented on the land reform, and land restitution and the ownership and the backlog. Those is actually good to hear that. It's very critical. I think I would like NUMSA also to focus on the 26% unemployed, because a lot of your focus is on those who have, and to make sure that they keep what they have and to create more. But I think there's a stronger focus on unemployment, and therefore there is the call for government to start programs with the, like the youth incentives to create more work. Thank you.
Thank you to the honourable members. If you want to see what the department spent on consultants, read the annual report, financial statements, you'll pick it up provincial and nationally, as well as in municipalities. I'm going to give the BUSA and NUMSA 10 minutes each to respond to you. You've got the questions that came to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I will ask my colleague to deal with the one issue of the balance of investment within South Africa and in the rest of Africa. But in the meantime, let me deal with some of the other questions, very pertinent questions that have been raised. Firstly, to deal with the issue of taxation, of course, as we know, the mini-budget is not the place where there's usually any reference to taxation, although there was last year. But I think the way we see it in business is that there is a committee of inquiry now appointed under Judge Davis, to whom we are making submissions. We are very comfortable with the terms of reference. We think it's right that at this point in time we should be looking at the tax system, because you can't say, well, over time we want to align our policies with the NDP, but we're excluding the tax system. I think we have to see whether the tax system as it now operates, whether it is aligned with what we want to do eventually. So certainly we hope that there will be no key decisions on any tax changes taken until that committee has reported. There will, as you know, be some of the interim reports that may come out. I believe one will come out on small business before the end of the year. But we certainly think that's the agenda that we need to look for before we anticipate any further tax changes. The issue was also raised of the consistency within the NDP. I would suggest, Chair, that it's the other way around. If it is correct, and I'm drawing on official statements from the highest level, that the National Development Plan, it trumps all other plans. Those are the words. So the other plans have to be consistent with the NDP, not the NDP to be consistent with them. I mean, as an overarching approach. And the point we've made is that, obviously, since we're still in an early phase of the NDP, there are still some of these inconsistencies that we've identified talking within business. They say, yes, but IPAP says this, and the new growth path says that. Well, we think this must be part of the work in progress, is to sort that out, because it's very important for business. To come back to my overarching point, we're hoping that through the instrument of the National Development Plan, we can move towards an environment, a policy environment, of greater certainty and predictability and less, of course, inconsistency. So certainly we think that might be something, Chair, which your committee may wish to press in its report. The third point I'd like to address, ready to kick for touch, if I may, because it's a very technical point, that is how you redefine the deficit. It's not something that I would like to respond to now. We haven't had a chance to discuss it within our own ranks, to talk to our economists within business. So I would prefer to come back on that at a later stage as to the new formula in regard to the deficit. The next one is the converging questions on the amendments those tax incentives, which will be discussed this week in regard to the subsidization of youth employment. Let me just put it this way, Chair, that as we see it, and I want to emphasize that these numbers are rough, but what we're trying to leave with you is the thought that, once again, comes back to consistency. in the sense, Chair, that if we're saying we want to create jobs, then we must have an internal consistency. And all we're saying is that the research to which we are, well, firstly we say that in terms of the motivation for the tax incentive, the expectation is that 200,000 jobs will be created. That's the expectation. We obviously would have liked a stronger incentive, just as there are some things in the NDP would have liked to have perhaps different. But the fact is, there is something here that is going in the right direction, and therefore it has the support of business. On the other hand, the research done on the labor law amendments, and we can send you that research, says, depending on certain assumptions, if those amendments are applied in full, you could lose between 30,000 and 100,000 jobs. So all we're saying is just bear this in mind, although they're running on separate tracks, they actually have to end up at the same destination. That is, how many new jobs will we ultimately be able to create? And that is our overarching concern. The next point is the issue of whether we are a drag on growth in the world. Well, I think we're probably too small to be a drag on the growth in the world, but we're certainly making a difference in Africa. And I found it interesting, we found it interesting in Busa a few months ago when I think it was the African Development Bank, I think I'm going back actually to the new year, early in 2013, when it made a forecast for the continent, but it divided for the first time the forecast into two parts, with South Africa and without South Africa. So they first gave the forecast without South Africa, and it was like 6%. And then they said, and we include South Africa, it's 5%. So the issue is we're not performing as well as we should within the context within which we should be judged. We can do better, and we should do better. The issue of, I certainly think that the issue of growth, once again, we must also, I know someone will say, yes, but growth isn't everything. Well, of course it isn't everything. But you want inclusive growth. And I think the bottom line, Chair, is try and do some of the things you want to do without growth and see how far you get. And, of course, you only have to look at the mini-budget to see what the constraints are when you cannot have more taxpayers, when you cannot move more quickly. So that's that point there, Chair. And then the issue of regulation. Now, this has been a constant theme. I think it's a theme of which this committee and indeed other standing committees in Parliament are very much aware. It's in the new growth path as well. Some of the earlier documents at GISA, I can't remember how many times we've been here before. So that's common cause, that we do need to lighten, the regulatory. It's not a zero-sum game, Chair. In a mixed economy, there will be regulation. But let's have smart regulation, smart tape, not red tape. I think the problem for many small businesses, and if you look at the competitive index, one of the pillars in which we seem to be deteriorating is how long it takes to start a business, for example, and how many steps you have to go through. And every time a new piece of legislation is passed, another layer is added. That's why, Chair, you've heard me say here before, and this is an important point in the National Development Plan as well, or at least it is referred to, that we need to make more use of the regulatory impact assessment mechanism in order to see what the impact, among other things, would be on small and medium business of any new law or any new regulation. It doesn't mean you have to accept the outcome, but at least you can make a better judgment call if there are other considerations that outweigh those findings. So I think the important point here, Chair, is that that we need to emphasize the extent to which when we look at fiscal numbers and we worry about growth and we worry about private investment and we worry about entrepreneurship, which as I said to you is really by world standards very low in South Africa, those 11 million jobs are not going to come because we say so. It's going to come because between government and the private sector, we sponsor entrepreneurship on a much bigger scale. and I suggested that we should be setting a target, an aspirational target, at least among all the other important targets by which we will measure how much closer we're getting to what we want to see in 2030. And finally, Chair, just as an overarching point, I think the important strength of our discussions here and in the NDP, I'd like to say that one of the strengths to business of the NDP is that it avoids the isms. There's nothing there about capitalism or socialism or communism or globalism or neoliberalism. It's just pragmatism. That's the ism. That's the ism we want. And I think if we put on that pair of spectacles, then I think we'll find that we'll make a lot more progress. For example, I've said to business people, do you know that in the NDP it says you've got to do something about executive pay? Now, they get very uncomfortable about it. I said, that's part of the deal. Because it also says there's been a tax incentive for youth employment. That's also in there. So I think we have to really be very much pragmatic. And also the issue of non-core assets and core assets and who should run them and how much room have we got to maneuver. I would simply leave you with the thought of a Chinese political leader, and he wasn't speaking racially, but when he was taxed or asked, now how do you explain the phenomenal success of China over the past 30 years, high sustained growth and so forth, and he said, we were very pragmatic. He said, we didn't ask whether the cat was black or white. We just asked whether it would catch the mice. Thank you.
Just to add on that, I fully agree with you. The higher the risk, the higher the return, except that capital chases growth. We have seen and heard that particularly sub-Saharan Africa is the second fastest growing region. But as we have just heard now, the South African economy is pulling down the region in terms of the growth. And therefore, it really doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure where to invest. Just to give you an indication, in terms of the entrepreneurial attitude, which is published in the Global Entrepreneurial Monitor, South Africa is ranked, or at least 35% have hope in terms of making business. But then when you look at other African countries, Angola, for example, is 66%, Botswana 67%, Ethiopia 65%, Nigeria 82%. So South Africa, even the perception of entrepreneurs, it's fairly low. And I should think that one of the things is that if, for example, we introduce some regulation, and which fortunately, or at least from a rational perspective, it is vital to fair and sustainable working market economies. But then if you have a constraint in the domestic market and the other countries that you are eyeing on in terms of making investment, if they say to you that we are left in terms of this particular issue that you are worried about, I mean, clearly that coupled with the growth prospects, you're most likely to invest there, because at the end of the day, as the executive, you're accountable to the shareholders, and the shareholders, they would want return in terms of how much capital they put in. Thank you.
Thank you, Numsa. I took 12. I'm going to give you 12 as well. 12 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. I'll start off with a question on the Parliamentary Budget Office. Just about a week ago, I was at a presentation. The office, an official from the office, made a presentation at a budgetary. It's an NGO budgetary and expenditure monitoring forum had a workshop, and he invited the PBO to present there. And the PBO did present. They presented a set of slides which they actually presented a few months ago. So there was nothing new in their presentation. I was a bit disappointed. They just dished out the old slides. So one couldn't quite gauge what progress they were making towards the establishment of the office. I'm not disputing the role that the office should play in beefing up the capacity of parliament and the parliamentary officials. I think that's clear. But is there a role for the PBO beyond? Because parliament as an institution is here to promote parliamentary participatory democracy. So is there a role for the PBO? How would it interact with, for instance, communities that come here and communities that want to actually present on the budget? What sort of backing does it give? What does it listen to their voices, or is it simply a prerogative of its functions are limited just to Parliament, and it doesn't, or there isn't a kind of interaction role, an interactive role that it will play with social formations outside of Parliament. And I think that's something that must be cleared up. There was a question, at least a comment on the strong language. I note that, and but I must say, we've been using the union, the language of the union hasn't really changed. It has a particular style of conveying and expressing itself. I think investors by now are used to the language of the unions. We don't use this language just to discourage investors, but at the same time, if investors are coming into this country, then we want to ensure that they are long-term investments. They're not short-term capital gains that's going out quickly, coming in, going out quickly. That they're long-term investments, and that these investments are, and that they do address the triple crisis of poverty, unemployment, and inequality. But I will take the point back to the union and say, look, the member of parliament does take a bit of exception to our language, and maybe. To in our strategies and how we express ourselves, maybe we'd have to see what alternate language we can use. The thing about local manufacturers and how would Treasury, now Treasury has an office of the chief, there is a chief procurement officer. I think we must be, when the minister says, and he made this reference in his medium-term budget policy statement. He did make a reference to a BMW 5. I don't want to go into the whole language of how we measure what is moderate and what is not moderate. I mean, it's completely different, you know, set of measurements that we could use. And like I said, what might be moderate to one might be very, very excessive to somebody else. The point is this, is that we should be supporting local manufacture. And we have 7 manufacturers in this country. And I'm going to also pick up on the point that you raised. We have Merck and BMW here. We know that. They are manufacturers of really more luxury vehicles. They do manufacture, but not, I think it's limited to the 3 and the C-Class. Which I might add, compared to the equivalent imported vehicles, have a very high rating. A few years ago, a comparison was done between the locally produced, there's a whole lot of vehicles, different classes and categories, and they compared very well to the imported equivalent. So we do have. We spend, the government spends, Treasury, so the money goes from Treasury, billions in incentives to these automotive manufacturers. So we can go into a long debate on that, but our position is we support local. We have proudly South African at NEDLAC. We keep talking about proudly South African manufacturing our own clothing here. So we stand by that. We stand by that. The thing about consultants and how would we... This is a very difficult thing because We've heard the chairperson did say that you have provincial, national level, provincial level, municipalities, but we've got to ensure that the kind of tightening of monitoring and the one area that we must try to avoid is sometimes there's duplication of work. A study done on more or less the same thing, and I think if we go through this very, very carefully, we have to. I'm open to correction here, but we cannot afford to have duplication of studies. And if a study is commissioned by a department, then I think by all means, before somebody else commissions anything out, we should make sure that there is no duplication, and that the terms of reference. It's just that it's a mammoth task given the multitude of organizations and departments that you have. I just want to respond to the thing about the NDP, yes, there's been previous policies, obviously growth employment redistribution, as GISA, new growth path, and government has run with its policies, even to the dissatisfaction of the unions. Where will the unions? We can't, even if government runs with something and we strongly disapprove or we have different views, we cannot abdicate our role as a trade union. And our role as a trade union is we have to look after the interest of our members, and we have to go on with the day-to-day business of the union, and that is to service our members and ensure that the rights are protected and that we engage in collective bargaining. So when it comes to issues of policy, yes, there would have to be, I think this is the number of forums for further political debate. We can't run away from that. And I think there are structures for that kind of debate. Within the alliance, which the Federation belongs to, there are structures for this to allow and permit for that kind of debate. I'm not going to be drawn onto this responding on the EITB, the Employment Incentive Tax Bill. We've had our say on that bill 2 weeks ago. I don't have a broad mandate, and I don't carry a broad mandate from COSATU. We, as a NUSA, we've made our position, and I've restated that position, and that's where I'm going to leave it. I don't have a broad mandate beyond that, so I would leave it at that. There are the issues that Minister, at least the Member of Parliament Harris has put about the deficits and that we can't allow them to run too high. The issue of lack of capacity when it comes to infrastructural spending, he's mentioned that, it's lagging by 22%. And I think there's space for more engagement on these matters. Clearly, and I've said this before, and I'm repeating myself again here now, and I'll probably say the same thing when we come here in February, is that we don't have the space and luxury for a macroeconomic debate here. I've mentioned the UNCTAD report. It's a case of preference that some prefer the International Monetary Fund. Fine. But we take a much wider view. We feel if there's an IMF report, then let's look at it. But there's an UNCTAD report. We must look at that report as well. And there are different instruments. Clearly, there are policy instruments that are being advocated in one as opposed to the other. We must look at all these policy instruments. I don't think we must become just selective because of the International Monetary Fund in its Article 4 report said that. We have to be open to us. We have to open ourselves to the kind of policy instruments that are being advocated. And I think the United Nations report deserves some attention, even if it hasn't been given that in the media. Having said that, I would stop here. I don't think there's anything more that I need to add on.
Thank you. Co-Chair Somadi wants to pose a question.
It's not really a question, it's a comment, probably. Where Professor Parsons will help us as we move forward about this growth in Africa, 6% ex South Africa. But just before that, as much as NUMSA says, do not want to be drawn into whether there are discussions or not within the alliance, about everything, including the youth wage subsidy or incentive. The culture of our movement is that there are no holy cows. Everything remains on the table. That doesn't stop implementation. Just like here, labor movement had its own reservations from 1996 till today, still raises concerns, but doesn't stop the implementation. So I just wanted to say, we shouldn't behave as if the culture of the movement is eroded by disagreements when we are actually in the process of implementing policy. Those engagements will continue. I just felt it's important that we should make that point very clear to Honorable Harris, because he seemed to be very much interested as to whether there are discussions or not amongst alliance partners. Maybe he should also invite NUMSA, and we'll see if NUMSA will take the invitation to have a discussion on this particular matter. I remember, the Premier of Western Cape at some point wanted to go and join the March of COSATU to address workers in Johannesburg. Well, the rest is history. I just want to put it on that note. Now, coming back to Busa, you know, to what extent, in fact, what are the key drivers of the economy in Africa? This emerging market. Is it the formal or the informal sector? Entrepreneurship development. Because we are more of a formal economy by and large. And if such a study is not made, we'll not be able to say what lessons are we learning from our brothers and our sisters the continent in terms of economic growth. I want to premise this on the basis of our own experience in the early 90s, not late, mid-90s. The South African economy, as it was propelling towards almost 5%, 4.something%, there was a greater element of provincial intercompetition. And even the fiscal, the way, the division of revenue, you would have 75% meant for social or policy implementation evolved from national. You would 85%. You would not compromise 15% of your fiscal as a province for economic activity. I'm not sure as to whether that is still the situation now. You would have a province growing almost at 6%. I'm not sure which province in South Africa today is the fastest growing. Now, maybe it's tourism and all other things that is talking about. I want to juxtapose this. Africa, South Africa. Limpopo is somewhere not growing at 6% above national average. But if you subtract Limpopo's economic contribution into the GDP, it would not significantly impact of the national growth. It would not, because of the size of the economy growing from the bottom, you know, low base. I'm not saying South Africa is growing at a higher rate. Probably even in the world, economic growth, which is somewhere around 3%. I don't know what will be the impact if you remove a big economy like America and add it again, what the impact would be. Now, South Africa was at the slowest, not performing at the right level. Its inclusion and exclusion will have a serious impact because of the size of the economy that we have, that we are. So I'm not saying it's a justification for South Africa not to grow at the right level in terms of its peers within the emerging markets. But within the context of South Africa and Africa, that is very, very important. But for me, the key element remains. What are the key drivers of the economies in Nigeria, in
Ghana and all that, so that we are able to learn. Probably the answer is an over-regulation of SMME in South Africa. Because I think we need to cascade down growth. Provinces, cities, townships must be seen as areas of growth rather than areas of service delivery and processation and nothing else. Now, at local level, what are the key elements that need to be factored in to ensure that you have got small and medium enterprises growing? So those are the regulatory issues that we need to deal with. So I thought I should just pose this question, and probably a study needs to be made from your side. The last point is what the opposition normally raises, to say we are not doing enough in terms of getting the continent and so on and so forth. But from a political and government, there is no better performance that the current administration has done to normalize the relationships between SADC and the continent, between South Africa in SADC and the continent as a whole. We have normalized relationships with Angola, which is a big economy on its own. The question is, to what extent are the South African business or corporate following the initiative of government? As you say, the higher the risk, the higher the profit. And I think Checkers has done a very, very wonderful job. Yeah. If you go to Zambia, you go to Ghana, and so on and so forth, and probably they'll be moving to the DRC very soon. It is not what government is not doing. It is what business is not doing. And I think that emphasis must come, you know, to follow the initiatives of government. I have just had an opportunity to take one of the five group top construction companies within the top five. The level of not ignorance, knowledge about Africa is appalling. You were asking questions, when we land in this country, will we have security? Who's going to escort us? Where are we going to sleep? This is a multinational company listed in South Africa, probably in the London Stock Exchange. The question is, what is business doing to engender interest and knowledge about Africa in the business sector? Is there infrastructure? No, in the continent. But is there a support for infrastructure? The African Bank, Development Bank, is there. Our own DFIs support that initiative. To what extent are South African cooperatives in infrastructure in particular taking this advantage? In fact, some would actually go to the extent there's no infrastructure. They don't see that as an opportunity. The fact that there's no infrastructure in the rest of the continent or limited infrastructure must be seen not as a problem, but as an opportunity to go in. So I think as much as we say government this, let us also begin to be frank about the things that we need to do and communicate amongst ourselves, between government and business, on how we actually complement each other on these issues. This week, a delegation led by the president in DRC, there will be business people in that. The question is, to what extent do they follow up? Because a marriage can only be made by two people and two parties. A marriage counselor can come in between, but they are not going to be there forever. Thanks.
That's a very crucial point made by Honorable
Chair. Are we
yes.
asked to respond to it?
If you want to respond,
yes.
To
well, I think Chair, the co-chair has raised some important perspectives, and I'm going to briefly ask my colleague to respond on one or two perspectives. Just to say, I think that these comparisons are important, but at the end of the day, all roads lead back home, in the sense that this country cannot only grow at 2%, irrespective of what other people are doing. But it's good to know other people with similar circumstances doing better, and is there something we can learn from them. But we are part of an interdependent continent, and so as the co-chair rightly pointed out, in sub-Saharan Africa, we make a big difference.
and we want to make sure that we will be able to implement those steps that will enable us to grow at 3, 4, 5, and 6%. I would just make the point, coming back to the Chinese input, a few years ago, I had a Chinese professor come and see me about these very issues that have been raised by the co-chair, and before I could get started, and as you know, once I get started, it's not easy to stop me, so he stopped me, and he said, but look, you know, I said, well, you know, we have some challenges here. He said, look, you don't understand challenges. And I'm going back to when they were growing at 10 or 11% in China. He said, we have a runaway train. He said, you don't understand. That's a huge challenge to have to deal with that. He said, what do you recommend? I said, give me that problem. Give me the problem of growing at 10, 11%. I know there are problems. But you tell me how we get 2 and 3 up to 6. And what are the lessons we can learn? So there are those perspectives. Let me also just say, before I ask my colleague to say something, is that just to create a perspective as to whether the glass is half full or half empty here, there is a World Bank report which indicates that if you list all the projects in the rest of Africa by country, by foreign country, or at least not foreign country, but other than South Africa and other parts of the world, that South Africa is at the top of the list of projects in the rest of Africa, but not in amount, of course, obviously. I think it's the Americans seem to be at the top of the list, followed by one or two other well-known countries. But so I think there is a proactivity there. Secondly, before my colleague speaks, also to say, from an institutional point of view, there is a SADC Business Council, which meets regularly and seeks to try and promote growth and development and, of course, trade opportunities and so forth within the region. And that's certainly something which enjoys a high priority within BUSA. Can you just add something on the issue of the sort of whole African perspective?
I think to a large extent, I got confused as I was trying to scribble here because some questions were answered along the way. And of course, we do agree. But for me, to a large extent, the price of a listed company, for example, gives some indication in terms of the potential of that company to generate wealth or return to the investment. Now, if you take South Africa as a company, and you price it at this growth, clearly there is a mismatch. But having said that, in terms of the growth in the African countries, yes, you are right. To a large extent, you find that growth is driven by the informal sector. Something that in our case, for example, as you correctly mentioned, one of the key issues is the regulatory environment. If you take, for example, that the small businesses are normally family businesses, one metro and so forth, and that person needs to, you know, to be an accountant, to be all these other things. Now, much of his time is taken away from generating revenue or sales than from sales and then substituted by compliance. And it comes very much often in the, what you call the service. And just to elaborate more in terms of domestic growth, I have indicated earlier that the business community is engaging with government. And core to that is to answer the question, how do we get South African economy back on track? Now, the key issue there was a business, I think in February during the first meeting, business was given an assignment to go and investigate the key things that can unlock investment from the business community. And we consulted with our members. We compiled a proposal which
was tabled to the president and his cabinet minister on the 6th of August. Now, from that, what we further did was to come up with the work streams. What are the specific action plans that needs to be taken by whom? Which is something that will be presented in the near future, I think sometime in November.
Thank you for the presentations, Magusa and Nomsa. Solidariteit, New Year is gekom. We are all human. We're going to have a comfort break for 10 minutes, and then we want you back in the committee room that we can take the briefing presentation by solidarity. Thank you.
Thank you. But if you look at the pieces of this two, three,
how would you choose?
thank you, honorable members, for your cooperation. We're going to proceed with the agenda. Preparing for the committee now is solidarity. Mr. Peter Roo, Kakum Nira Roo. And we are listening to your briefing, your input. We're going to give you 20 minutes.
Thank you, Chairman. Just a quick note for the benefit of the audience with regard to the presentation on screen. I'll be deviating from the, I'll be making separate remarks. The submission stands as it is, but I'll be making additional remarks, so it won't be, if the screen does showing the presentation, I won't be working off that.
Do you have an updated presentation?
It's just that my remarks will not be the same as that which is written in the submission.
It's very important for the compiling of our report, because the personnel sitting here will have to do that this afternoon, and we would like you to assist them with an updated version in a hard copy.
Well,
not only for them, but also for the members. So if you haven't got it ready now, after the meeting, just to give it to the secretariat, Mr. Wickham, Mr. Vento, that they can circulate.
Very well, I've prepared the remarks, and I will give it to you afterwards. The chairman and members, it never was and never will be the case that all that is worth pursuing and worth having can be bought in the market. It is part of our human condition that all the time we must give without expecting something back, and that we must receive without offering payment. In fact, not only is it unavoidable, but people seem to direct their resources toward non-commercial ventures all the time. Yes, humanity benefits greatly from market exchanges. Their profit help guide us toward sensible resource allocations, but it improves also by resource allocations not aimed at showing money profit. Chairman, the world is a better place because people act charitably and philanthropically for public benefit, and as well as commercially, and usually in combinations. And Solidarity, the organization I here represent, is a testimony to the philanthropic spirit among people, an example of how people can commit to collective action for personal and non-personal benefit without being forced to participate. Nevertheless, it has become established and widely accepted practice among citizens as well. That states tax the inhabitants. Tax is the primary source of revenue in the 2013 medium-term budget and policy statement we consider today. In this 2013 statement, it is the fiscal framework by which it is proposed that the South African state should operate for public benefit. And in this framework, we find items of revenue and items of expenditure. While tax is the primary source of government revenue, taxpayers don't provide it all. To finance its substantial budget deficit, the government runs up debt, expecting future generations to pay for current expenses. Even if they do not have a choice in the matter, hardworking South Africans are, by and large, willing to pay tax. The reason they are thus willing is that they believe that paying tax can be for the public benefit. And since they want to contribute to the public good, they accept taxation. However, among tax-paying, hard-working South Africans, a conviction has been growing that their taxes are contributing increasingly little to the public good. My goal here today is to convey this sentiment of skepticism. A real sentiment and a swelling sentiment. Certain things aggravate such tax skepticism. When Finance Minister Pravin Gordhan, in delivering his medium-term budget policy statement, that speech, he thanks everyone from President Zuma to the South African Revenue Service, to the South African Reserve Bank, and many other public office holders. It spares no word for the 3.3 million income taxpayers who contribute 99% of all income tax in South Africa and the bulk of other taxes. When this happens, taxpayers hear that they are being taken for granted. When they
hear no apologies about how they hard earned money. Money, the loss of which they had consoled themselves with in the belief that it would be available to public benefit, have been wasted and given no reason to believe, no real reason to believe, that next year won't be business as usual, and they are encouraged in their skepticism. When Minister Gordhan announces tax relief, our taxpayers then go and look at the numbers and see that total tax revenue still increases. They have reason to feel affronted. When Minister Gordhan announces cuts in government's liquor bills, credit cards and so on, estimating that 2 billion rand may so be saved, then taxpayers welcome it. But they immediately wonder how such lavish practices came to be established in the first place. And when taxpayers then do the math and realize that this 2 billion rand amounts to 0.19% of total expenditure, they are assured that there is no real commitment to cut back on what has become an oversized bureaucracy. When taxpayers read the newspaper and see, as they do in today's Beeld, that the National Intelligence Agency appears to have been operating on a 14 billion rand budget per year without the requisite financial oversight for 3 years now, they wonder if their money really contributes to the public good. And when they see how the Department of Correctional Services finances its court cases to defend the policy of making their workforce representative of the national race demographics on every level and every site, they wonder, could it be that the money we pay in taxes does not contribute to the public good, but actually sometimes to the public bad? Chairman, I wish to bring to the attention of this committee that when the medium-term budget and policy statement projects revenue for the next few years, it takes taxpayers granted. Let me speak on the tax burden in South Africa by focusing on the income tax, the largest of government's tax sources. Personal income tax is the single largest expense in the budgets of many employees and virtually all Solidarity's members. A very small number of South African taxpayers bear almost the entire weight of the South African state on their tight shoulders. And in analyzing recent income tax statistics, the first figure that stands out is that 13.7 million people are registered as taxpayers, and I'm speaking about the 2011-12 tax year. 13 million are registered, 13.7. However, as can be seen in the graph in our written submission, only a small number of those registered actually paid significant amounts of income tax. Of the 13.7 million people registered in 2011-12, 3.3 million taxpayers paid about 99% of all income tax, 2.3 million paid 93%, and 1.5 million paid 84%. There aren't many people in the effective tax base, Chairman. And this shines through in public sentiment. A case in point is the ongoing e-toll saga, which, while ostensibly about the tolling of public roads, really draws its greatest strength from the general disillusionment with government's failure to deliver on what people expect for the tax. In a moment, I will come back to this point about tax expectations. But before doing so, I want to briefly sketch Solidarity, the organization I represent. Solidarity is a labor union representing an integral part of the backbone of the South African economy. Its members are employees, companies, in nearly every industry in South Africa. The main industries where Solidarity is organized are metal and engineering, mining, electrical industry, telecommunications, chemical industry, agricultural, general industries, including tertiary institutions, aviation, and other specialized areas. Solidarity's mandate, as is the mandate of unions generally, is to protect the interests of the workers who are its members, and as such, Solidarity is exercising its mandate by commenting on the MBPS. For this forum, our mandate is particularly strong. From our information on our members' income levels, Solidarity estimates that its 130,000 members are responsible for a minimum of 5% of the personal income tax paid to SARS in the 2011-12 tax year. 5%. While our 130,000 members belong to us so that they may derive personal benefit in the form of improved labor relations, they also belong to us in order to support our work from
co-chair stand to derive no direct benefit. Without commercialization and without maximizing profit, Solidarity, through the generosity of its members, has spawned numerous other non-market organizations. These organizations include a successful technical training college with almost 1,000 students a year, a charity, bursary schemes, and more. Incidentally, it was Solidarity and its family of organizations who provided the primary emergency food and other aid to the BEE trap of misery that was the Aurora mine disaster, and not government, who was rather responsible for the legislative framework that made Aurora possible. But the point is that Solidarity acts charitably and sources its contributions voluntarily. The bulk of these achievements have been accomplished through the aid of monthly membership fees from hard-working salaried South Africans. They opted for a voluntary tax of around 10 rand a month from their after-income tax to finance these public benefit activities. When our members compare what we achieve with the small monthly contributions they entrust us from their after-tax income with what government achieves with the virtually incomparably more money taxed from our members, they become disillusioned. They might want to reallocate more money to us and to other charitable organizations, and there are many in South Africa, and we should be thankful for them, to make up for where government does not provide all public benefit that can be provided. They find it very hard to do once income tax, their single largest expenditure, has been subtracted from their salaries. I said before that taxpayers feel they are being taken for granted. Let me return to this and make concerns of our members, concerns which are likely shared widely by taxpaying non-members as well. Let me make it more concrete by way of 4 points. Solidarity's current position on government revenue and expenditure in South Africa is as follows. Among our members, and I think among the public in South Africa in general, there is a willingness to contribute to the public good. Solidarity's members are willing to contribute substantial proportions of their income to causes that deliver little personal gain, but does improve the general level of well-being in South Africa. And the very existence of Solidarity is testimony to this. Insofar as they feel that social well-being is furthered by tax, so far Solidarity's members are willing to pay tax. But the second point is that there is wasteful expenditure. Solidarity's members are tired of the high levels of wasteful expenditure, public inefficiency, and corruption by public office holders in South Africa. They are increasingly convinced that, had they not have had to pay so much tax, they would have been able to improve social well-being better than the government does by contributing the money to carefully selected charities and other not-for-profit organizations. The third point is that there is an increasing tax burden and an increase in welfare state. Solidarity is convinced the current tax levels already exceed anything the government could spend efficiently. We are of the opinion that further tax increases are not a viable answer to current government and public sector problems. Furthermore, it remains our view that South Africa is on an unsustainable welfare path. Not only is the welfare state financially unsustainable, but it is also crowding out market and civil society initiatives necessary to restore vibrancy and dignity to community life. Once taxes have been paid, where must South Africans find the resources to be charitable, with responsibility, to be philanthropic without being profligate, and to provide employment opportunities that translate into greater general prosperity instead of being unsustainable, subsidized? And our fourth point is that we think that there should be rebates for expenses where state services fail. All of Solidarity's members and most South Africans perform for their own expense many services typically thought of to be a function of government. And Chairman, I would submit that all the members here do it as well, by paying for their own private security. For example, in February, Solidarity pointed out how much suburban South Africans may have to pay out of their after-tax income for their own safety and security because of government's inability to curb crime. Solidarity remains committed that South Africans should become eligible for tax rebates for private provision of so-called government services where those services are absent. In particular, Solidarity maintains complete in February. That South Africans should be eligible for tax rebates for personal security expenditure in the same way that they are eligible for tax rebates on personal medical expenditure. Otherwise, we would have the absurd situation that you can get tax back to stay healthy, but not tax back to stay alive. Solidarity was happy to receive a commitment from Treasury in February this year. They will engage us on this proposal of tax rebates for personal security expenditures. However, we are even more disappointed that in spite of the earlier commitment, we have since not received answers on our repeated letters to the Minister and his spokesman about such engagement. Nor have we had a reply on our request to have our proposals considered by the Davis Commission tasked with a review of the tax system. It would be a major comfort to taxpayers if this rebate proposal does somehow find its way into February 2014's budget speech. I'll conclude, Chairman, with final remarks. With the above comments, Solidarity wishes to alert the Standing Committee on Finances that South Africans, including Solidarity's members, are increasingly dissatisfied with the weight of the current tax burden, the way taxes are spent and wasted, with the way in which South Africa's growing welfare state is crowding out market and civil society initiatives, and with a refusal to seriously entertain their request for tax breaks for supposed government services, which they effectively have to provide for themselves. In short, Solidarity, whose members contribute 5% of annual personal income tax, is concerned that taxpayers are being taken for granted. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. LaRue. As far as I know, it's the first time since 2009 that Solidarity appears before these committees, referring to committees, this is a joint meeting of the Select Committee for Finance and the Standing Committee for Finance in terms of the Moneyballs Act to deal with the NDPPS. And your input is mainly referring to tax. There was public hearings on the tax amendment bills a week or 10 days ago. So I don't know if you made a presentation there as well. You said you submitted your presentations to Treasury. I want to propose to you that you make use of these committees because our meetings are open for the public. It's a people's parliament, and that you more often do a presentation here that we can also capture that in our reports. That's why we are here as representatives of the people. So I just wanted to give that clarity, honourable members. Excuse me, questions? Let me start here at the top. Morales, Van Royen, Joseph, Adams, Van Meer, Ross, Gurdorf, did I skip someone? No. In that order?
Thanks, Chair. I think you were probably correct in saying that the presentation is slightly out of place considering we've done the tax laws and the NDPPS tends not to deal with tax proposals, but I think the presenter does make some important points around principle and how we design our fiscal policy on the basis of a relatively small set of income tax payers or taxpayers in general. I wonder what Solidarity's view of the Tax Review Commission is. Have you been approached by them? Have you made inputs to them? You seem concerned that there will be tax increases coming down the line. I would be very surprised to see tax increases in an election year. So I think you might be right for after the election, but certainly I doubt that there would be tax increases before then, although you never know. But generally when this committee questions the Finance Minister on tax, he kicks concerns to the Tax Review Commission. Are you that that commission will be able to take on board many of your concerns and hopefully design a better tax system that you would be happy with.
Thank you, Chair. In his speech on the MTBPS, our current Minister of Finance cited the news flow characterized by negative narrative as the biggest problem, one of the biggest problems that we are faced with to deal with issues of a building, I mean the business or the private sector confidence in our economy. And as a result, leading to major challenges around issues of economic development. He further emphasized that it doesn't only take good policies or good legislation. And then for us, I mean, to boost the economic, I mean, the confidence of the private sector in our economy. Linking, of course, it to the necessity of ensuring that we change the narrative of the information that we are communicating to the broader world about our situation here in South Africa. What's your take about that statement? Secondly, you made a very general and strong, and where I'm sitting, a very baseless statement that tax revenue is abused. And from where I'm sitting, as someone who has benefited quite extensively, either directly or indirectly, to the yields of this new dispensation, I know that out of tax revenue, education has been enhanced. Out of tax revenue, the less fortunate have been able to be housed. Out of tax revenue, the previously disadvantaged are currently enjoying, I mean, provision of basic services like electricity and water. Out of tax revenue, I can proudly say most of the basic needs of our people have been addressed. Now, what is the base of this strong statement, which is too general? Are you? Because I would vehemently disagree with you if that what I've cited is not the benefits of tax revenue. Thank you.
You got charges?
Thank you, Honourable Chair. I just want to make a few comments. And the following is that the statement made that future generations are to pay for current expenses, I think it is also true that future generations will pay for current decisions, and we are busy with decision-making. It's our prime task in Parliament to create the laws that will serve the country in the best interest. But if I take you back, if the leaders 50 years ago have made the statement that you made, maybe would have been in a different position in South Africa. Because we are now also now paying for that decisions that they have made 50 years ago. And I would say, I would want to disagree with you. Next year cannot be business as usual because the minister made statements, made announcements, and we here to implement, to hear the public view, because we would like to implement their decisions that is to the benefit of the people. In fact, it was a leadership's announcement that the minister said we must start with the leaders, ministers, the DGs, top senior officials, and then take it further down. But the details followed in the committees. So we must ask, we must also ask, how did we get to the situation in the first place? And I perhaps wanted to hear more from you from that side. What caused that with the government of Africa in this situation? And was because of good governance or bad governance, and how do we get out of the situation? Now we acknowledge that we are in a situation, we need to get out of it, and the minister has come with some proposals. Governments are taking taxpayers for granted. I think you've repeated that several times. Very strong statement. And all I want to say, I acknowledge your members. You're speaking on behalf of your members, and I want to acknowledge their contributions and their willingness to pay for public good as you, if I may quote your own words. So one must appreciate that that willingness still to contribute with the right to question what happens with the money, what benefits you get. And I think an example you made, if you want to feel safe in your country, you want to feel safe in your home, you don't want to walk, do not want to walk around with fear, and you want to enhance your opportunities for your family, yourself, your business. I think that is the issues we must speak on to. It's very important, because that is where additional taxes after deductions you pay for, and I think you are correct there. And the other point, the last point, Honourable Chair, is what was mentioned, that more growth will bring more economic opportunities. And I think we need proposals on how to enhance the growth within our current environment, or government must create the environment so that organizations like yourself and other organizations can enjoy the benefit and the opportunity. So I see your sentiment in that as well. Thank you.
Roy Adams.
Thank you, Co-Chair. The first one is in your introduction that you say solidarity is concerned that South African taxpayers are being taken for granted. I can say emphatically that is not so, because year after year, National Treasury always thanks taxpayers for their contribution. And you say that your 130 members contribute to personal income tax. But then you say later on in your subheading Solidarity's Members Personal Income Tax that there are 13.7 million. Now, if you work out the percentage of 130,000 against 13.7 million, that is a very, very small number. Yeah, it's a drop in the ocean. And then Jefferson, I'd like to know what Solidarity stance is on the implementation of the employment tax incentive. What do they say about that? Because that will create jobs for the youth, of which their members' children are also unemployed. Thank you.
Thank you. Honourable Ross.
Thank you, Chairperson. The remarks with regard to the small tax base, I think it's well taken. It is a concern for many of us, but I believe, in all fairness, the Minister has also indicated that he's concerned with regard to the small tax base on several occasions. Perhaps the recommendation from the Chair is very valid that, you know, ongoing participation for committees would be useful. Seeing the small tax base and how do we extend that base would be the challenge. And I would like to have Solidarity's view with regards to the comments that Busa made earlier this morning with regards to improving access to finance and support services, especially with regards to the financing of smaller business, where we can have significant growth in smaller business and extending the tax base and perhaps addressing your problems. What is the position of Solidarity with regards to smaller business and your incentives in terms of financing and perhaps assistance to smaller businesses? Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Can I just also welcome Solidarity? I think it's about time for them to come in front of this Parliament's committees, and especially when we're dealing with a budget. So I hope this is the start of a proper engagement in future. Then just in general, you know, I think if you pay tax with regard to yourself as fortunate, and, you know, you've got to work, so that is good. Nowhere in the world you will have taxpayers embracing government all the time. They don't like to pay tax. It's inherent of human beings. And so I don't think any government can take them for granted, and it will be wrong. And if that is the perception, while I'm in the opposition, it's slightly different to that. I think our finance minister is very grateful, and in many speeches he has made previously, he is thanking the taxpayers of South Africa. I think you're making some value point. The perception, the perception is here, and I think any government must take cognizance of that. There is a perception out there that their money is not spent well, and people are fed up with regard to that. But let's not play the game so that we're trying to ring fence our taxes. And let's not play the game of trying to be in certain camps. We're all South Africans. We're all part of the history of this country, and we all must take this country forward. So I would like Solidarity also to play that game in a more South African way than only in a category of their members. I think it's important, and it's important for us all if we want to go forward. They say more wealth was created since 1994 in this country than the previous 300 years. So I would like the Solidarity to look at that statement made by Koos Becker, the boss of Naspers, and unpack it a little bit and see who has benefited the most since 1994. So let's engage. It's good. Elections are coming up, you know, all over the world, in Greece, in Germany, in the United Kingdom, the United States. Taxpayers use the ballot. It's over to Solidarity to do the same.
Thank you to the honorable members, Mr. LaRue. I am proposing to you that you also look at all the recommendations as two committees made, as well as the two committees and appropriations to the Minister of Finance since we started to be in office in 2009. It's on record, and the Secretariat can help you with that. And the Minister replied to all our proposals, and it's captured in regarding appropriations in the Division of Revenue, and when it comes to finances in the budget review. It's on record, so I want you to have that look as well. And it's, you'll see, it was the outlook of this government to broaden the tax base in South Africa and to create more jobs. Take people as getting a welfare grant and give that person a sustainable job. That's the target. That is the target. And I think we all must go back to the reconstruction and development plan's principles. What does it actually mean when we started in 1994? It's crucial. And where we are now. But thank you for your presentation. You may respond to the questions.
Thanks, Chairman. On the issue of the appropriate forum for a presentation like this, while I've spent much of what I've said and much that is written in writing submitted to you is on tax, it is the issue that I want to put on the table and Solidarity wants to put on the table is about the old fiscal framework. And I think we are exploring channels to have our tax proposals on the table of Minister Gordon, as I've said, and we will continue to explore those. This sentiment that I wanted to convey is the general, is very applicable when one considers the fiscal framework for South Africa in the coming years. A number of members have mentioned that this might be the first time that Solidarity attends a portfolio committee sitting or a standing committee sitting. We do so on numerous occasions. We may have been at this one a while back, but we have limited resources from the 10 rounds of our members, and where there are so many committee sittings, from employment equity bills to black economic empowerment, this that we can't attend all of them. But we certainly will continue this engagement with the resources available to us. It was said that I've made a baseless statement that the tax is inefficiently spent. Now, some of the other members have, I think the Honourable Member Joseph has alluded that might actually indeed have some merit. And I invite the member who believes that this is a baseless statement to read some of what many government officials often themselves say, that there is corruption. that there is inefficient spending. You've mentioned that how that with tax money education is funded. That is true. About a third of people entering the school system end up with a matric certificate. That is inefficient compared to anything that is could be relevant for this committee. I think there is, it is very with merit, it is with complete merit to say that much of the South African government's revenue is spent inefficiently. There is much room for improvement. The answer is not more tax or more revenue, but the answer is less tax and better application of that money. It is true that if what I say now should have been said 50 years ago, then I'm very happy that you say that, because it says that what I say now is with merit as well. That is, it applies equally to all times, I think. I'm not sure that taxpayers in South Africa drew from Minister Gordhan's speech and from his framework statement that next year won't be business as usual. As I said, the cuts announced on credit cards and liquor, that is, it's not even worth mentioning in the bigger picture if you look at the total numbers, total amounts we're speaking of. And it is certainly so that even if some of the members may disagree with me on this and other points on whether government is inefficient, whether there is corruption, it is certainly the perception of the South African taxpayer, the tax base. And this should be taken very seriously, I think. A quick calculation on the relevance of Solidarity's 130,000 members and the 5% they contribute to personal income tax alone. The member, Adams, has actually strengthened my point. She said that there is 13.7 million, I said, registered taxpayers, and Solidarity has only 130,000 members. That means that less than 0.9%, about 0.9% of 13.7 is our members. Yet they pay 5% of income tax. They far, far out punch beyond their weight. So it's actually remarkable how much Solidarity's members contribute. But as far as the Employment Tax Incentive Bill and other measures to improve small business and employment opportunities and so on, Solidarity's view is that the sustainable job creation happens in the market and not through subsidies. And we see little value in taxing money away to create jobs instead of leaving it in the hands of consumers or businesses to spend as they fit. A case in point, which adds to the, let's compare something to the Employment Tax Incentives Bill. Let's look at the Unemployment Insurance Fund, which last year took in more than double what it needed to pay out in benefits. If it had cut its fees levied on South African employees, which can be as much as 2% of their salary, if the Unemployment Insurance Fund levied only half of that, it would have literally it would have put money in the hands of employers, which they were already willing to pay on salaries, to around 200,000 laborers at, say, the minimum wage for agriculture, in the agricultural sector. And we can change that to about 130,000 people, jobs funded at 4,000 rand a month. That's an entry-level job. So there are other ways, lower hanging fruit, to improve the employment situation in South Africa, and that is by leaving the money where it can be best spent, and that is in the market. It is probably quite correct, so that more wealth has been created in South Africa post 1984 than ever before. You can look at any, almost all economic data available, and you will see that, and that is to be welcomed. But that does not, however, detract from my points about the tax base, about how South African taxpayers perceive how they are being viewed and their contributions, that their contributions aren't valued and taken for granted. I think I'll end with those. I think I've touched on all of them, Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. LaRue, and thank you for doing your presentation. And we would like to see you again here in Parliament. The national budget will be tabled in February, if I'm correct, the 14th of February. So then there will be public hearings as well. Honourable members, that brings us to the end of the presentations. Co-chair, are there any inputs from your side? I was told that we will reconvene as a joint committee tomorrow at 9 o'clock, and the venue will be S12A, which is just behind the NCOP chambers in the old building, to consider the report. So the committee section has got a mammoth task this afternoon to capture all the inputs that was made. With that, honourable members, honourable Harris.
So, Chair, did you say 9 o'clock tomorrow?
Oh, 9 o'clock. Yes.
9 o'clock. Okay, thanks, Chair. Just another question. It's not for the NCOP. It's for our chair in the NA. I note that on Friday, the debate on the Financial Services Laws General Amendment Bill was added to the program. I believe when I was requested whether there should be a debate or a statement, I said there should be a debate. I requested for a debate. I understand that it's now been tabled as a statement. But, Chair, I think the committee, or members of the committee, have the right to request a debate, and I certainly did request that.
Of course, yes, it is going to be a statement today. Yeah. You're entitled to that.
Chair, I understand. If it's not a debate, then it's a statement with declarations. But the point is, Chair, the whippery is saying that this committee took a decision to schedule a statement instead of a debate, and that's just entirely not true. I requested, when asked, a debate, and the members of this committee have a right to request a debate that needs to be granted. There was no decision taken to have a statement instead of a debate.
Okay, Honourable Harris, I think...
Sorry, Chair. Can I request that, Chair, you release the present and then you engage on your committee matters, please? Thank you.
We have welcomed your presentation. We've engaged with it. You are released. Thank you very much.